Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming to our first Penn Lecture of 2015. Buenas tardes. My name is Elizabeth Starchevich, and I'm the president of Penn San Miguel. And can you all hear me? We are of the I don't hear so well age. So please just quietly raise your hand. As you all know, Penn has a series during the winter, and our winter series is meant to collect money to help writers in prison and writers in difficult political situations. As we're all aware, at this particular moment, the situation in France for the press and for writers in general and the larger society has come under attack. And I'd just like to mention to you that Penn International has a petition, if some of you would like to sign it. And the way to find it is www.penn.org. And you can always ask someone after the event. Penn is an organization of writers that defends freedom of expression. It's located in about 140 countries all over the globe. And in Mexico, we have three centers. One in Mexico City, one in Guadalajara, and one here in San Miguel. So I'd like to make sure that you all come and support Penn, and so we have membership outside. Our dues this year are 400 pesos or $40. Our wonderful speaker, who has brought lots of books, and books will be sold at the end of the speaking, is here, and she will be introduced by our Secretary, Treasurer, and International Vice President of Penn, Lucina Catman. And thank you all for being here. Come often.
Hello. I was delighted to hear that it would be my opportunity to introduce C.M. Mayo. C.M. Mayo, I've read a lot of things of C.M. Mayo's, and I've listened to a long essay on CD. Along the line, I've read a great deal and found out a great deal about her. She's a fabulous historian, and she's able to make people interested in things that they might not otherwise be interested in. I was absolutely astonished to hear that, to notice that I would listen for an hour about someone's trip to Miramar Castle, which is somewhere near Slovenia. I don't have anything against it, but it kept my interest. I also, a lot of people love her book about the last prince of the Mexican Empire, which is based on, she is not a fiction writer, mostly anyway. She writes about history, but it's so amazing that it seems as though it must be fiction. She's got a lot of books here. The new book that she'll be talking about, which is about Madero's secret book, and also The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire, and I think I saw it in Spanish version. I heard her in English and in Spanish. And she's very good in both. Very equally interesting, I thought. I think it was at the field in Guadalajara where I heard her in Spanish. And some others. She's done a book about Baja California. She also did a whole series of podcasts called Marfa Mondays about a sort of extraterrestrial part of Texas. She's a longtime writer and coordinator of Madame Mayo's website. One time I was invited to be a guest author on Madame Mayo's Bible's website, and that was one of my most fun moments because I got to discuss comparative paw prints. I was using paw prints, real paw prints, in writing a math book. And at that particular moment, I really knew a lot about comparative paw prints, and I did not really have a good way to publicize this, and this was a perfect opportunity. Anyway, that's a bit of a detail, but I think maybe in some aspect of what I've said, you'll understand that we're extremely fortunate to have a guest, C.M. Mayo.
Yay!
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for that very kind introduction, Ms. Cyan. Thank you all for coming and for supporting Penn. And thank you all with Penn, who worked so hard to make this reading series possible. Ms. Cyan Kaufman, Elizabeth Starkovich, Pat Herschel, and all the many volunteers. Thank you. Especially fun to be here and sad to be all day. You know, day. It's one of those. But it's also a town full of readers and writers, and many of you are our writing friends, so a special thank you also to those of you who are here. I'm going to be talking about my new book, Metaphysical Odyssey into the Mexican Revolution, Francisco Armentero and his secret book, The Spiritist Manual. But some of you might be thinking, wait a minute, didn't she already talk about that, about this book here in San Diego? Well, back in late 2011, on its centennial, I published a Kindle edition of, is the microphone okay? Yeah? Is a little feedback? Should I stand back a little bit?
Yes.
Would that help? Can I come back here? Okay. Are we doing okay now? Sorry?
Oh, I can't hear you.
Okay, it's okay now?
Yes.
So back in late 2011, on a centennial, I published just a Kindle of just my translation with like 5 pages of introduction. That was it, of Madero's Spiritist Manual. What I'm going to talk about today is my book. I bought that book, so it's new. And there's a lot of new research, and there's a lot of surprises I uncovered in there. And there's sort of a loosest head of questions. Who was Madero? Did he really write the Spiritist Manual? Why in heck did you have anything to do with that? And so on and so forth. So I think the most efficient way for me to answer those pressing initial questions is to just start by reading the opening pages of the book. So I'll just read this brief section. When Halley's Comet, that star of the Quetzal's tail, flared across Mexican skies in 1910. It heralded not only the centennial of independence, but a deeply transformative episode, the revolution launched by Francisco Armendaro on November 20th. What Javier Garcia Diego calls, quote, the true beginning of a process, the birth of the modern Mexican state. The great chorus of Mexican historians agrees. And yet, almost unknown and curious as it may sound, a vital taproot of this revolution lies in the Bernalillo district of New York State. As a writer of both fiction and nonfiction, I have learned to appreciate the fact can be stranger than anything one might imagine. Before returning to the Bernalillo district, a word about Francisco Armendaro and how I came upon his Manual Espírita, this until now obscure and yet profoundly illuminating book, at the very least for understanding Madero himself, why and how he led Mexico's 1910 revolution, and the seething contempt of those behind the overthrow of his government and his assassination. Madero was a Colombian rancher and businessman. Without his daring and passion, the revolution might not have begun when it did. And without him, modern Mexico might not have been able to rightly call itself a republic. Francisco Armendaro was none other than Mexico's apostle of democracy, who rejected a stolen election and took up arms to bring down Porfirio Diaz, the military strongman who had ruled Mexico directly and indirectly for more than three decades. When Diaz fled to Paris in 1911, Maduro did not see himself upon the presidential throne. With an interim government in place, he once again campaigned throughout the country to become Mexico's democratically elected president. And only after unequivocally winning that election did he take office later that year. In 1913, but 15 months into his term, Maduro was overthrown in a coup d'etat engineered by a cabal of conservatives and the influence of a meddling U.S. ambassador, and then, with shocking casualness, executed. The Mexican Revolution then exploded into a new and more violent phase, churning on until 1920, with Álvaro Obregón's presidency, or, as some historians argue, the end of the Cristero Rebellion in 1929. Popular imagery of the Mexican Revolution usually features rustic characters and bandoliers and washtub-sized sombreros, such as smoldering eye Emiliano Zapata, with his handlebar mustache and skin-tight trousers, or Pancho Villa, who always seems to wear the smirk of having just quaffed a beer, though he was a teetotaler, more likely it was a strawberry soda. Thus often, I was shown Don Francisco, handsomely dressed scion of one of Mexico's wealthiest families, usually bareheaded, occasionally in a top hat. For he was, and remains, a confounding figure. He was a spiritist, and what the devil is that? I had no idea, and until 2008, it had not occurred to me to wonder. I had just finished writing The Last Prince of the Mexican Empire, a novel based on several years of original archival research into an episode during Mexico's French intervention of the 1860s, the so-called Second Empire under Maximilian von Habsburg. I mean to say, spending an afternoon delving into an archive, I am heavier than a cat after mice. At that time, my husband was in Mexico's Ministry of Finance, which has a number of archives, among them Francisco Armendaro's. His archive is available to the public. But thanks to my husband's invitation, I have the immense privilege of viewing it in private with the curator, Marta Lopez Castillo. When we arrived, she had arranged a selection of the most outstanding items on the table that spanned nearly the width of the room. Maduro's Masonic regalia, photographs, documents. We went down the table as she explained the importance of each piece. Years earlier, on a tour of the National Palace, in one of its parade of ornately decorated rooms, I couldn't have told you which, I had seen the bureau that still bore the bullet hole from the shootout between General Victoriano Huerta's men and the presidential guard that ended with President Madero and Vice President Pino Suarez taken prisoner. If I knew anything about Madero, it was because I had been living in Mexico on and off for 2 decades, and in Mexico, Madero has a stature comparable to Abraham Lincoln's, in the political historical sense, not the physical. For Madero was short, with a bald head, and a neatly trimmed triangle of a beard. In portraits, Madero appears kindly, yet dignified. One can easily imagine him managing a prosperous complex of farms and factories as he did. The few moving pictures of him reveal a theatrical and bracing energy. Maduro was also distantly related to my husband's family. A paternal uncle had married a niece of Maduro's. In sum, what I knew then about Maduro amounted to little more than the barest gloss of the story Mexican school children learn, but certainly I was vividly aware of his transcendent and deeply respected role in Mexican history. Now, halfway through this presentation, my gaze fell on a little book
My model is Fita by Bhima, B-H-I-M-A.
Who is Bhima? I asked.
Madhava himself, the curator answered.
I had picked it up and was already leaping through it.
Los Invisibles, Krishna, Moses, La Doctrina Secreta.
It seemed a farrago of the Bible, Madame Blavatsky, and Hindu whatnot.
Really, I said. Bhima was Francisco Madero?
Yes.
I knew instantly and absolutely that I had to translate this book into English.
Had it been translated?
No.
Are you sure?
This, too, seemed too extraordinary.
I assure you, it has never been translated.
Within a week, I had received Zarab's copy of this strange little book, and I began my self-appointed task, which turned out to be a Mount Everest more than I imagined.
Why had I left it? Apart from an intuition, as a translator of poetry and literary short fiction, I knew how little Mexican writing appears in English. And translating Madero's relatively simple vocabulary and syntax in a word barely big enough to narrow to a spine seemed a lark of a project.
Oh, maybe a couple of weekends?
Yet not 3 pages in, I was dumbfounded. I had no context for such ideas. Frankly, it gave me the creeps. So instead of translating, I started reading, 4 years worth of reading. And this, for the moment, brings us back to the burned over district of New York State. Once the heartland of the Iroquois Nation, this approximately 50 by 500 kilometer swath of verdant Yankee farmland between Albany and Buffalo got its name not from any fire, but from the fiery passions of its 19th century religious revival movements. Traveling preachers built billowing tents with celebrants, and Mitch Horowitz writes in Occult America, quote, "For days afterward, without the prompting of ministers or revivalists, men and women would speak in tongues and writhe in religious ecstasy. Many would report visitations from angels or spirits." A few outstanding figures in the long list of those who traveled through, settled in, or departed from the burned over district include Jemima Wilkinson, the public universal friend who called herself a channel for the divine spirit, the utopian Amida community, the Millerites who sold their worldly possessions in expectation of Judgment Day in 1844, Shakers, Quakers, Joseph Smith, founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who claimed to receive instructions from the angel Moroni to unearth the golden plates of the Book of Mormon, and most relevant to the story at hand, the Fox Sisters of Hinesville. So at this point in the book, it gets kind of crunchy in the history of metaphysical philosophy. I go into the history of spiritualism, some of its roots in Swedenborgianism. Immanuel Swedenborg was a very influential Swedish mystic. I was a little bit about Sir Kipsey under Jackson Davis, and then how American spiritualism crossed the ocean and came to France, where it was sort of codified in a lot of books, some of them further channeled material by Alan Kardec. So the main spiritist, the spiritualist or the spiritualist, that then became spiritism, spiritists in France. But spiritism has its roots in spiritualism. It's a little bit different, I go on about that. But basically what happened was, Madero, as a young, wealthy, niño bien, norteño, Mexicano, he goes to get his education in Paris and encounters spiritism there, the French version thereof. What is spiritism? Well, we talk about an hour about that. But I'll put it into a nutshell for you if you're not familiar with it. Spiritists talk about how it's a religion and science, but basically the idea is we are not our physical body, we are spirits, and as such we are immortal, and we are destined lifetime by lifetime, not by any ritual intermediated by clerics, because of course the Catholic Church didn't like that, not by any ritual intermediated by clerics, but by freely chosen good works,
to evolve into higher, ever higher levels of consciousness, and so return to God. So that's more or less in a nutshell the idea. Well, if we are spirits in bodies, well, then couldn't we also have the spirits who are not in bodies? Well, that's the idea. So Maduro was a medium. He was a spiritless medium. He was not just a believer, but he was someone who spent a great deal of time developing his psychic abilities to, he believed he was communicating with spirits as a writing medium. In other words, he was channeling messages into a notebook. And then later, in about 1908, he sort of graduated from that to pure, what he called inspiration or telepathy. So that was kind of the idea in a nutshell. I want to hasten to add here that I know this sounds really wild, but I'm not the first to talk about this. Maduro spiritism was something that was rumored. There were a lot of cartoons about it at the time. It's been mentioned in different books. But basically, we could count on one hand, but there are five Mexican historians that know who have written about this. And probably the most important one was Enrique Krause. He's a very well-known Mexican historian. He often writes op-eds from the New York Times, so you may have come across it in English. He wrote a biography that's brief, but it's a big book with a lot of pictures called Francisco Madero, Mystico de la Libertad, that was published by one of Mexico's most important presses, Fondo de Cultura Romántica, in the late 1980s. And he was really the first serious historian to bring forth the fact that, well, he was a medium, Madero was a medium, here was the evidence, here are the mediumistic notebooks, and we know that he was blah, 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 blah. So there are all these kind of basics with a brief outline of the history of spiritualism and spiritism and so on and so forth. It got a little deeper with the work of Manuel Guerra de Luna. Manuel Guerra de Luna is a biographer in the Maduro family of Maduro, and he's also the screenwriter for, he wrote the screenplay for a documentary called Buenos Aires Días de la Revolución Espírita, 1910, The Spurs Revolution, which you can find on Vimeo. It's a really well done documentary. I really encourage you to look for that. I linked to it from my webpage on the resources for researchers, part of my webpage about the book. Manuel Guerra de Luna, he's, to me, I think knows the most about Maduro and spiritism of anyone. Another one to mention is Alejandro Rosas, who published back in 2000, the year 2000, a multi-volume series called Las Obras Completas de Francisco Madero, The Complete Works of Francisco Madero. I'm going to talk in a minute about Francisco Madero's most important book, which is a political book, La Sucesión Presidencial de 1910, or The Presidential Succession of 1910. But Madero wrote many other books, and of course he had these mediumistic notebooks, and he also had a lot of correspondence. And so Rosas put that all together, including the Manuel Espirita, but I actually had a very hard time finding that. On the internet, it turned out to be a big help later to find some of these things. But two others worth mentioning are Gloria Tortolero, who wrote her PhD dissertation at Colegio de México, El Espiritismo Seduce a Francisco Madero. Spiritism Seduces Francisco Madero. And this is really a magnificent book. The thesis was published as a book in, I think it was 2004, about 10 years ago. It's only available in Spanish. A very small edition, but it's a very important book. She really, really went to the archives and really worked with the archives. It's absolutely outstanding. And one other to mention is one of Mexico's greatest literary artists, Ignacio Solares. And Ignacio Solares wrote a novel called Madero, El Otro, which is also based on, I think, very sophisticated metaphysical understanding and research. So these are the few people, there's a few others to mention, but basically those are the very few people who have written about it. What is really surprising is you can pick up a textbook on the Mexican Revolution, and even some of the works by leading historians on the Mexican Revolution, and they won't talk about Maduro's spiritism, or they'll just kind of put it in a footnote. The leading biographer of Maduro is with Stanley Ross. The spirit's name was in a footnote, which Why is that? I think the material makes people very uncomfortable. I think they don't like to talk about spiritism, the idea that Maduro was communicating with disembodied spirits, or at least he believed that's what he was doing. For a lot of people, that's just a very uncomfortable subject. They just jumped to the assumption that he was crazy. Maybe he was schizophrenic, maybe this, maybe that. They just don't want to think about it. I often say, it's kind of like if somebody shows up and says, let's talk about alien abductions and crop circles, you know, the room will clear out, right? And I think that's the reaction a lot of people have to material, which is unfortunate because it doesn't allow us to really look at what's actually there. My contributions with my book, apart from the translation of the memoir of Scudina, are that I provide an overall narrative for the story of Madero's biography. As you will see, it's written as sort of creative nonfiction, so it's a biography. I offer as much of a sort of crunchy archival stuff as I can, but I try to make it readable a little more like a novel, although it is not a novel. I think I'm able to provide clearer and deeper connection to the metaphysical and political context of the United States and the role of our very unfortunate ambassador at the time, Ambassador Wilson. The other thing I was able to do that was really, I'm very proud of this, and it was actually Manuel Guerra de Luna who really encouraged me to do it. I was able to work through my daughter's personal library. His personal library has only become available to the public in the last few years. It's in Mexico City, in Chimalistac, in the Centro de Estudios de Historia de México, which is in my house. So I was able to go very easily many, many times, which was good because I would often look at things without realizing what it was. And then I would have to go say, well, you know, who is this person? And then do some research and then come back. And so it was kind of like trying to solve a puzzle. But I was able to find a lot of things that were really very interesting. And I don't have a lot of detail about this in the book, but I found a lot of works by Anita Sand, Madame Lebowski, some of the leading theosophists. Although Madero did not consider himself a theosophist, he was very influenced by some of the same things. The Bhagavad Gita, he was very enthusiastic about the Hindu holy book, the Bhagavad Gita. He had works by Dr. Peebles, who was a leading spiritualist. And probably, as Swami Vivekananda, there were a lot of books from Barcelona, from the Biblioteca Orientalista. There's a lot to say about the Spanish connection there. And Dr. Carmen Heller, that was one of the things that was most fun for me, was, maybe I'll leave that in the Q&A section, but Dr. Carmen Heller was his personal doctor. Dr. Carmen Heller was a German spy, and Dr. Carmen Heller was an artillery expert, and Dr. Carmen Heller, it turns out, was a very important figure in, I would say, mostly early 20th century esoteric literature. There's a lot of, if you go look for them, there's a lot of books by Dr. Carmen Heller out there, and one of them is in Madero's personal library, and he wrote that one as Maestro Wiracocha, and he signed it to his hermano Rosicruciano. So they were both Rosicrucians, they were both Masons, they were both spiritists, they had a lot to do with each other. So the whole Dr. Carmen Heller story, there's quite a lot to say about that. And it gives a connection when we try to create a context for Madero's ideas. Dr. Carmen Heller was a student of Papus and Hartmann, and these are leading figures in the esoteric world in 19th century Europe. And then into the 20th century, he got to know Rudolf Steiner, and he later became very close to Aleister Crowley, who's a ginormous figure in 20th century esotericism. So that's really interesting. And the other thing that I was able to provide, I think also some more context with some of the other figures who are close, they're not necessarily spiritists, they're closely related to that, and that would be the Santa Teresa de Calcuta, that would be the Niño Fidencio, Doña Pachita, and they are similar to some of the spiritist psychic surgeons in the Philippines, which is another particular esoteric type. So, one of the things that took me so long to write this was when I come across stuff like that, and I'd be like, whoa, psychic surgery? Wait, whoa. Like, it just took me a while to be able to read about that. But then I was able to. And then finally, the connection that goes to President Elias Calles, who came a while after Madero, who was also a very important spiritist and was very active in seances. And there's a lot to say about that, so I brought up that very bit in the book. What I'd like to do is just give you a little bit about my adventures in part of the Metaphysical Odyssey into Explorations, about my research in personal libraries, and just to give you very brief brief little flavor of that adventure and how it lived is, I want to read to you just a couple of pages from the section called Doña Sara. And Doña Sara, that refers to his wife, Sara Perez and Manuel. Very slowly, in several visits over several months, I combed through my rose library in the intervening days and weeks, trying to make sense of what I found. I made many scrambles down many rabbit holes, as it were, some empty, but for a dead beetle or two, some draped in velvet and thick with coffee-inducing incense. I had seen a good portion of his library when the archivist brought out the black leather-bound book with his initials, F-I-M, embossed in gold on the lower right corner. This was Dimas Manuel Espirita, the same I had seen so long ago, but that one cheaply bound in thin paper in the Ministry of Finance. And so I held this finest monogrammed century-old book, the object of all these years of reading and research and reflection in my hands. Slowly, I opened it. The front and backboards were papered in a William Morris-style pattern of moss green leaves. The inscription was to Sara Perez de Maduro. That same afternoon in the archive, I came across Adrienne Majewski's Médiumnité récente par l'application des fluides électriques, magnétiques et humains. Healing mediumship by application of electric, magnetic, and human fluids. As I thumbed through it, I found, tucked in tight, an envelope with the typed address, Doña Sara Perez de Madero, Zacatecas, 90, Mexico, DF. The post office had stamped it for June 16, that is, June 4th, 1916. A little more than 3 years after she had been made a widow. By this time, she had returned to Mexico City from her exile in New York and New Jersey to this house in the Porfirian neighborhood built over Aztec floating gardens and 19th century surface grounds. She had no children. She lived alone. And now, summer of 1916, the hero's widow, a nearby standard, the revolution grinds on. General Victoriano Huerta, the traitor, is already overthrown, dead of cirrhosis of the liver, and buried in El Paso, Texas. U.S. Ambassador Henry Lane Wilson, whom Huerta had asked, should Maduro be sent to the lunatic asylum? And who had answered, after all his outrageous meddling, after Huerta's troops had tortured and killed Maduro's brother Gustavo, whatever Huerta thought right and best for Mexico, has been recalled in disgrace. The U.S. Navy has already retreated from its occupation of Veracruz, and now General Blackjack Pershing's troops, including my dad's old friend Rob Smith, are chasing Pancho Villa like a dog after its tail around the desert. Maximilian von Habsburg's nephew, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, has been assassinated in Sarajevo. Now the Germans intrigue for an advantage, fighting on every front of World War I and fighting among themselves over increasingly Byzantine strategies regarding Mexico. Emiliano Zapata, the campesino leader of Morelos, is still alive and fighting, as is his nemesis, the also soon to be assassinated president, Venustiano Carranza, whose constitutionalist army overthrew Huerta. The cities are plagued by strikes, the countryside by banditry, the peso buys less each day. June is the rainy season in Mexico City. The trees turn lush and the air, back then, would have smelled sweet, even on the grayest of afternoons. Even in the midst of political chaos, the city goes on. Imagine, from the roof next door, where a maid is pulling down laundry, a dog barks. In the street beyond Doña Sara's window, umbrellas bounce by, and cars and horse-drawn wagons spray their wakes onto the sidewalk. Doña Sara, surrounded by her books, sits on her sofa, her litter opener poised. I drew out the envelope's contents. a postcard of President Maduro on horseback, and a photo, sepia with age, a middle-aged man seated in profile whom I did not recognize. Behind him and to the left, unnaturally, as if pasted in from another photograph, a blurry image that, for the shape of the face and beard, could have been Maduro. A hazy woman to the right, and floating midair, front and center, the large white blob of a baby, a spirit photograph. Who sent it to her? I found no return address, no letter. Who slipped it into Majewski's Medium de Guerrison? A cataloger? Another researcher? Was it Sarah Perez de Maduro herself? Another battle, Majewski. One could write a book about him, but all suffice to know that a Google search brought up the news that three of his photographs of hands emitting magnetic fluid, photographs reproduced in Majewski's book, were sold by Sotheby's at auction in New York City in December of 2012 for $18,500. What would really come back to the main point, which is that the evidence is overwhelming that Maduro was, in fact, not just a spiritist, not just a believer, but he was a leading spiritist. He was an evangelist. He was an organizer. He published a lot of articles in addition to the book. He personally subsidized many magazines about spiritism. So even if he had no political role whatsoever, if someone were writing the history of spiritism in Mexico, he would be a key figure. He was also a medium, and we know this from that medium's notebooks and also from his correspondence. And his philosophy is, you know, basically he believed that his spirit was immortal and that he therefore had a moral imperative, a duty to act, to do the right thing, was what really brought him to become a revolutionary and take the risks that he took. There were reasons for the revolution. Well, I was going to read that section, but it would take too long. There were a lot of reasons, obviously, why Mexico was getting ready at that time to have a revolution. But it didn't just come up from nothing. There was a very, it was very well organized. And it was very well organized by Maduro. And what's very interesting is that the way that he organized it was with his book, La Sucesión Presidencial en los Últimos Días, which was the presidential succession in 1910, which is a book that was basically his political platform. But the way that he used that book to organize his political career is precisely the way he used spiritist literature to evangelize. It's the same thing. So he wrote the one and then he wrote the other. And I think what I'll do is just read this brief section about the two books, the Sociación de los Últimos Días and the Memoria Espírita, and then I'll end that a little bit and go to Q&A. This is from the end of the last chapter of my book, and it's called Abismo Corrido de Guerra, two books. When we talk about a successful book, usually what we mean is one that has a brand name publisher, enjoys prime shelf space in bookstores, and earns its author buckets of royalties. In other words, we talk about it as a commodity, or if we're much more sophisticated, a hybrid commodity slash work of art slash scholarship. I say we because I'm writing, and I presume you are reading this, in a time and place where books are no longer banned by the government, their authors no longer casually imprisoned, or worse. Lulled by endless streams of made-for-the-movies thrillers and romances, we forget that, as Ray Bradbury put it, a book is a loaded gun. Francisco Armadero intended his Memoria Espírita to be a beam of light, to heal Mexico and the world with his consoling concept of the nature and meaning of life. However, it is a book that stands on the shoulders of his first book that was indeed a loaded gun. La Asociación Presidencial en 1910, published in the winter of 1909, when Don Porfirio Díaz, the dictator who had stolen the presidency and ruled Mexico on and off for over 30 years, was about to celebrate his 80th birthday, and as Mexico's so-called necessary man, himself a seventh term. Maduro had an interest in the capitalist concept of the book's success. He wanted La Sucesión Presidencial de 1910 in people's hands and as fast as possible. And for that, he did not need bookstores. He needed a jumpstart on Don Porfirio's beliefs. He paid for the printing himself, a first edition of 3,000 and never more. And as he noted in the letter, the first precaution I took was to hand out 800 copies to members of the press and intellectuals throughout Mexico, so when the government got wind of the book's circulation, it would be too late to stop it. Enterprising, daring, and sophisticated he may have been, but because we are of his future, we cannot see Francisco Armendaro without also seeing his death. From that grim night of February 22, 1913, its shadow seeps back into his presidency of mere 15 months, his campaigns, both political and military, the writing of La Sucesión Presidencial de 1910, and, what interests us here, his second book, his Manual Espírita. Although the gun, alas, can spray fire in unexpected directions. And then, too, there are the real guns. So, thank you.
Wonderful, and I want to say, unfortunately, people are being put in jail for what they write. As we well know, this is a pen event. We have that always in the front of our consciousness. And one other thing that I didn't mention is that CMA was going with all of us to eat at the Vivali restaurant right in front of Bellas Artes. And those of you who choose to can have dinner with her. And they serve a free glass of wine with food. So
we have no second microphones, but we'll
repeat your questions and we'll just be loud.
Yes.
Because they're the transmission mechanism as well, you have in your representative. have a situation where you're out after 4 years or 6 years or whatever period you want, you end up with somebody like Rodrigo Diaz, which is analogous to Hosni Mubarak, for example. You know, somebody who they appear to get elected, but it's not really necessarily open and fair election. So they're kind of not really a monarch, but they're not really democratic. They're kind of in the middle. So the transition really is a problem when they get to be old or they get to be a problem. So there's a lot to say about that. But right now, Mexico's on the same system. I'm 6 years. You know, they're out.
There was a question back here. Do you think he had a calling through his spiritual side to become president?
Yeah, what shows up is that in many of his remembrances is that he was channeling spirits who were, well, he believed that's what he was doing. Whether you believe in that or not is another issue, but he believed that he was channeling spirits who were telling him, this is what you need to do. You need to write those assessments in town. You need to organize this. You need to, you know. He believed that that was his destiny. That was his mystical destiny, was to be the leader of the revolution and the president. Some were spiritist, some were, it was kind of all over the place. You would see the influence of Madame Blavatsky and some of it. My one sense about Hastings is that I think it's difficult to generalize. But I'm just to say, I'm certainly used to be a book about that, and I have not written that book. Someone needs to write it, Madara the Mason. There's a lot to say, I'm sure.
Did Madero believe that one created one's spirit through the moral journey, or did one enhance it and purify it?
Yeah, I think, I don't think he believed we created it, but I think what he believed is that we can choose through, actions and thoughts, we can choose to do things that will help us evolve. So the concept of evolution to higher consciousness was an important part of Spiritism. And he was very much about that.
Thank you.
Judeo Christian learning, and he's a very important figure in the 20th century. He died in 1986. And so, who was Judeo Christian learning, and did she believe this? Just because somebody has a book doesn't necessarily mean they read it or they believe everything that's in it. But I think it's very interesting that she had the book and she kept it, and that she clearly had some sort of friendship with the translator who was translating this kind of material. So, we just don't know. And again, I found the spirit of this photograph, which also suggests that she must have kept in touch with her spirit, so we're interested in that. But we just really don't know.
Okay, I think you'll be the last question. Thank you.
In the research of your book, did any of your beliefs change?
I got to the point where I could just stay really calm. Which might sound like a small thing, but I actually think it's kind of a big thing. I mean, I found a lot of resistance to this material at first. It was very difficult for me to read about channeling, and I was I don't want to go there. Or the whole thing with the 20,000 incarnations of Judy Krishnamurti, my first attitude was, oh, you got to be kidding, you know? But I kind of just got to the point where I thought, well, I don't have to believe it, but I don't have to judge it either. How do I know? You know, so like somebody says I saw the Virgin Mary in my garage, well, maybe they did it. Maybe they didn't. I don't know. And that's okay. Political historical sense.